In this episode, we dig into Charlie's past and some of the obstacles he had to overcome into getting where he is today. We cover how he dealt with his ADHD, how he managed to propel himself from having no money to having a successful business, and even how he teaches his kids some of the life lessons he learned while growing up. Charlie is an incredible father and entrepreneur, and I was beyond inspired after having this interview, and I hope you will too. So without further ado, here is Charlie Gaudette. Charlie Gaudette is the best-selling author of The Predictable Profits Playbook. He is a keynote speaker and creator of the Predictable Profits methodology and the most reliable way to systematically generate predictable profits for small businesses. He's been an entrepreneur since the age of 4, creating his first multi-million dollar business at 24 and has helped others generate millions through his strategy. He's received a lot of rewards, recognitions, and has given business advice around the world, including Inc., Forbes, Fox Business, as well as on podcast and radio. He was named one of the American Genius's top 50 industry influencers. He's a CrossFitter, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fighter, and three-time wrestling state champion. He lives in New Hampshire with his wife and three kids. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you have quite a list of achievements, and you also have a book. And would you consider yourself fairly successful today?
Yeah, I'd like to consider myself.
I know, it's a weird question, but when you started your business, you were just 4 years old, right?
That's right.
Can you tell me more about that?
Well, you know, growing up as a kid, I didn't really know my dad very much until after the third grade because he worked all the time. Every waking hour of every day, he started work before I got out of bed, came home after we went to bed and so forth. But the times that I did see my dad, yeah, on good days, he would tell me, "Hey, kid, if you ever want to make it big in this world, you got to be an entrepreneur." And then in bad days, he would say, "Hey, kid, don't ever be an employee. Employees suck." Mm. And so, yeah, I think like many kids, they want to have a connection with their parents and, you know, boys want to connect with their dads. At least that was my case. So I figured that the best way and the easiest way to do this is to show my dad that I could be a business owner too. And so I drew artwork and went to my neighbors and was selling my artwork to my neighbors because that's about the only thing I knew to do at 4 years old. And yeah, so that's how I started my first business. And my dad was proud of me. And so I kind of got the bug from that, you know?
And then since then, you've had other multi-million dollar companies. And in particular, then you went on to start another company at age 24. Is that correct?
Correct. So I've always been an entrepreneur. I've never actually gotten a traditional job. I mean, other than, you know, being in school and scooping ice cream and stuff like that every once in a while. But, you know, I've always been an entrepreneur. And at 24, yeah, I managed to, after several failures, actually made a few right decisions and created my first multi-million dollar business.
What were some of those failures that led up to your success in 24? You know, that you said you had the entrepreneur bug. So 4 to 24, what happened between then?
Well, one of my most proud failures, if I could even call it that, was I started a business. It was one of the nation's first pet health insurance companies. I started that right out of college. And we recruited a fantastic team, just a star-studded, wonderful team of some of the top insurance players and business leaders in the country. And we're meeting with venture capitalists all the time. We raised some seed capital. Ernst & Young selected us as one of the nation's best seed stage companies. I mean, I found myself in newspapers that I couldn't even read because they weren't even in our language. I really, at that point, thought for sure that I was really going to hit it big. And then we were promised several million dollars. The market fell with the dot-com crash in 2000. And the day that I needed the money, like at the wire, the investor showed up and said, "Guys, you've seen the market. I can't help you. No more money." And so actually that day I was sitting around the table and we had to close up shop because we just couldn't float it anymore. I mean, I literally put every penny I had into that business and was starting to go into debt. I couldn't float it one more day. Mm. So that was it.
How did you handle that? I mean, that sounds one of the biggest highs and biggest lows simultaneously. I mean, how did you build your character up from that point?
You know, it's funny. When it comes to professional type stuff, it doesn't bother me as much as maybe some of the personal events in my life. Man, my girlfriend and I at the time, we took off to Disney World right after that because we're like, oh man, what are we going to do? I mean, we did what every, you know, normal 20 something year old kid would do. Let's go to Disney, right?
Right.
And we sat there and we're like, so what are we going to do next? And I looked at, you know, I believe that you have to play the best cards that you're dealt. And everybody has different cards. You guys play with different cards, everyone on the planet. And you got to look to find out where the odds and where you're going to be able to play your best hand. And so one thing that I recognized is that, you know, my dad's been an entrepreneur. What's he doing now? And my dad was a real estate investor and a hard money lender. And so I'm like, all right, that's a card that I can play. So when I came home, my dad was going to negotiate a piece of property and I asked him if I could go with him. And he said, yeah, no problem. So I went with my dad as he was negotiating the piece of property that he owned. He said to the potential buyer, here's the deal. I will loan you the money for the property and I'll loan you money for the construction of the road and the first house. You're going to have to pay a much higher interest rate, but at least you don't have to go through the hassle of the bank. So the guy goes, all right, no problem. If you think about it, I'll give you a call tonight. On the ride home, I told my dad, if anybody else made you the offer, would you accept it? And he goes, you know, the first one to the table, we'll get the deal. And I said, fine, I want it. And my dad right away said, no, I told you I don't want in the, I wanted you to go to college so you didn't get into this business. Because he, real estate and construction and whatnot for him, it was tough, you know, tough on the family, tough on his life. Even though he made a lot of money, it was just tough. And he never really wanted me in the business. And so we ended up getting in a little bit of a scuff. Then he had issues about doing business with family. And so we got even more of a little bit of a tough there. And then finally we made an agreement that I would take the exact same deal that this other gentleman had, only the deal would be with my dad's lawyer and me, and my dad would be removed out of it. So if I didn't pay back the loan or if I messed up, the lawyer had all the rights to foreclose. And I mean, I ended up signing a document that was thicker than my own book. I mean, it was huge just to make it happen. So
was there a particular reason why you want to go into business with your dad? Or did you feel that it was, for lack of a better term, path of least resistance? Did you want to work with your dad? Is that something that you desired at some point in your life?
I didn't really work with him because he wanted to keep a distance because my dad he had loaned money to family before and family didn't pay it back. And then they ended up, you know, not talking and whatnot. So he made it clear that he was not my father in this transaction. This was a business deal. And the only reason really why I took the deal is because what I'm most passionate about is growing businesses. And I love that. It really didn't matter to me what business I was in. I've done so many different businesses that I loved growing a business. And so I figured this would be a good challenge for me. And here's sort of like an interesting tidbit of information. So here I am. I'm now in over $1 million in debt. I agreed to this deal, signed the deal with his attorney, the whole bit. And I knew nothing about real estate development. Nothing.
Wow. How did you build up the courage to go ahead and start doing that then?
Because at 20 whatever years old, I mean, I had nothing to lose. You know, I already came off like a failed business, right? So I had nothing to lose. When you're at the bottom, it doesn't take very much to, you can't go much lower, right? So, I mean, my biggest risk was the relationship with my father. And, you know, I figured worst comes to worst, I'd be able to find a way to, you know, sell off the properties and pay him back. But I might be, you know, I might not make anything. But yeah, I just had a way of figuring things out. And so I went to Barnes & Noble and I bought a book And I literally sat in the car reading the book on what I had to do. And then I needed to find subcontractors and whatnot. So I went to the other real estate. I went to the location of other real estate developers that I knew had a good reputation in town. And I wrote the names down of every subcontractor they were using. And then I called them to bid on the job. And then I would just ask good questions. Like, you know, my plumber would come in. I'd say, okay, so look, I want to make sure that, you know, I do this in a way that makes sense for you and nobody's stepping on your toes. So how would you like to see things run? Who would you like to see typically come in before you and after you? And do you have any recommendations? And they would give me their names. And so I'm like, cool. So then I'd go ahead and I'd hire them. And then I went to the building inspector and I said, look, I really want to make sure that I have a good relationship with you and the rest of the town and that I do things right. So can you tell me, how would you like to see things done? What is your definition of a successful project? And they told me everything that I needed to do to succeed. And so, you know, I didn't have to learn how to swing a hammer because I had other people to do that for me. And everything else, I had people who kind of knew the road to go already and they kind of walked me through it inadvertently. And then, of course, over time, you know, it didn't take long before I understood this stuff well enough that I didn't need, you know, I didn't need to go to people, but that's how I got started.
I want to switch gears here and actually talk about your ADHD diagnosis. Whereas a lot of people, they end up getting some disability or some diagnosis and they feel like they can't achieve something or that all of a sudden they're hampered from becoming the person that they had in their dreams or they won't be a successful entrepreneur because of this or because of that. And can you tell me about when you were diagnosed with ADHD and how that affected the way that your outlook on life and how you viewed yourself?
So before I got diagnosed, I always kind of thought that something was going on with me. And there was a part of me that wondered if I was dumb.
If you were dumb?
What was that?
If you were dumb, is that what you said?
Right, if I was dumb. Mm. Because I knew that I wasn't the same as the other kids in class. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And then my mom, actually, she had my parents, you know, education was really important to them. So they had us go to summer school every year. And one summer school that we went to, they insisted that we get tested for learning disabilities. And that's the only reason why I got tested. And I'm still kind of surprised at the way that the news was delivered. But the doctor sat down with my mother. And the doctor told my mother, your son has one of the worst cases of learning disabilities that we've ever seen before. She said, I have ADHD. I have, I didn't even know there was as many forms of dyslexia as there is. I thought there was just one where you see things backwards. That's the form of dyslexia I don't have. I think the only one, but multiple forms of dyslexia, got word retrieval issues, and there's, you know, a bunch more. And so now, you know, I don't really know the next part to be true. I just know this is what my mom told me. But I'm going to go with this is fact. So let's just play with this. This is fact. Because if it's not, I've been lying to myself for years and it's a good lie. But my mom actually said to me, because I got in the car and I was pretty bummed. I'm like, oh my God, the doctor just said that I'm like the most screwed up patient that she's ever seen. But my mom said, you didn't hear what the doctor said. I go, what do you mean? She said, you might have the worst case of learning disabilities that she's ever seen. However, she also said your IQ was one of the highest IQs that she's ever seen. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, that's the only reason why you've been able to get as far as you've already gotten in life is because your IQ is way off the charts.
Did you take a test for that? Or is that, did your mom just tell you that?
I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I don't know. And I'm not sure I really want to know.
Yeah, I don't think it really matters either.
No, because honestly, I think the power of the mind is, you know, so powerful, right? That just by telling myself all these years since I was a kid, I'm a genius. I just look at life differently than everybody else. I've got one of the highest IQs in the world. Yeehaw, I'm a genius. And so, again, I don't even know if it's true, but it's been enough to, when I know that I'm thinking differently or I'm struggling maybe, you know, with something that somebody else might get a little faster, in my mind, I'm going, that's okay. I got a high IQ. A different way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you can always go back to that and just say, hey, my mom told me so, so.
I mean, that's legitimate diagnosis, right?
Exactly. No, definitely. That's what I would say, man. No matter what, if you're in a confrontation with your wife, just say, hey, my mom says I have the biggest IQ ever. What do you have?
That's right. I mean, yeah. I tell my wife that all the time when she's like, hey, you forgot to do something, forgot to get something at the grocery store. I go, oh, I'm sorry. I have ADD.
See, now it's your secret weapon more than anything, right? You've learned how to harness it in your favor. But you know what's so I'm interested, actually. So you were talking about before that you felt that it was different growing up, that you felt you were different from everybody else. In what ways did you feel that you were different? How were you able to sense that?
Well, you know, I've never really been able to learn in a classroom setting. I couldn't do that. If I was going to learn something, it was on my own. And so, you know, I would see my other friends like pick things up really, really quick. And like, I wasn't able to pick it up until I did it on my own. Like, for example, in Australia, I studied in Australia for 6 months. I took this business finance class. Literally, like, I wasn't getting any of it. But the final exam determined whether or not I passed or failed. And I taught myself an entire semester of business finance in one day because I had no choice. And the way that I do things is if you look at my notes, like I'll make symbols or change different colors. And so if you ask me, hey, Charlie, what do you know about X? I'd say, okay, well, it's in the upper left-hand side of the page. There's a red key next to it. It is blank, and I'll give it to you. And that's just the way that my mind works. And that's where I'm really, really strong. And that might be the reason why I'm so great at what I do and helping business owners see different opportunities that they're not seeing in their business. But if you were to ask me to say, like my wife and I, we'll watch TV. She still laughs. She gets the biggest kick out of this. We might be watching a movie for like 45 minutes. It'll go on commercial and she'll ask me something about the movie. And I'll look at her and be like, what are we watching? And she'll be like, are you kidding me? You honest to God don't know what we're watching. We've just been sitting here for 45 minutes to be like, I have no idea.
Well, with that said, wait, are you actually paying attention to the movie or are you thinking about something else?
If I'm like, really paying attention. I like the show Homeland, right? If I'm really engaged by Homeland, I could tell you about Homeland. But if I'm not engaged, I could literally be looking at the screen for 45 minutes and then just nothing, 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 nothing.
Fair enough. So you learned how to learn. I mean, I think everybody's mind is a little different. And so you figured out the tactics that work out well for you. And how did you, how did you develop that? Growing up, after your mom said, hey, you have the biggest IQ ever, what led you to being able to learn how to learn? Because I'm assuming traditional methods didn't really work out well for you.
It was more traditional methods did not work and still to this day do not work for me at all. So it was trial and error. And, you know, when things don't work, you just kind of try something else and you try something else. And I was likely encouraged by my mother who said, you know, you just learn differently. You got to just figure out the way that you learn, your learning style.
But I think at the bottom of it, it all comes back to having that confidence in yourself. And when you're told you have, say, a high IQ and you firmly believe that, then that becomes you. And I know that there was one study that actually showed that when we feel meaning in life, when we think that we know ourselves, that allows us to be happy and to persevere. And I know that was actually part of Viktor Frankl's story from the book. What was the book name?
Man Searching for Meaning.
Man Searching for Meaning. Yes. And it was the people who were able to find meaning and perspective in life and appreciate what they have that were able to get through those hard times. And it doesn't matter whether it's true or not, you know, whether it's true or not, you have a high IQ, I don't think it really matters. It's the fact that you believe in yourself, because if you didn't have that confidence in who you were as a person, then you never would have tried, right? You know, and there's a lot of successful people in life who had doubts in what they could do, but if they absolutely thought they were dumb and stupid and couldn't achieve anything in life for the rest of their lives, they never would have attempted anything. And that's really a problem that I consistently see in a lot of our young today.
And you want to know actually the biggest secret that I learned only later in life that has helped me even through some of my biggest challenges in the world?
Absolutely.
This is going to sound crazy, and most people would throw me in a straitjacket and toss me in the back of a car and lock me up forever if I told you that this is actually my secret: gratitude. And when I say that, there have been times when, remember how I said that I've been close to bankrupt three times before in my life. And I'd be sitting there and I'd be looking at one point, I had like $38, I think it was like $38.25, something like that left in my name, and bills that were worth far more than that, that I had to pay. And instead of most people going, "Oh my God, woe is me, what am I going to do? I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to be this and that, blah, blah." I took a step back and gave thanks for that. And I didn't know why. And I was just so thankful to be in this position, to have learned a lesson, and that I believed to my core, and I still believe to my core, that every challenge comes in equal and opposite opportunity. And I didn't make this stuff up. The Chinese figured this out years ago with the yin yang, right? But I just believe to my core, just like I believe that I have a high IQ. I still believe I have a high IQ, right? Whether or not it's true, I don't know, but I believe it. And it's like the same thing with the yin yang. I mean, it could be huge amounts of pain, personal pain or financial pain or whatever, and just go, you know what? Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I don't know why, and I'm not even thanking anybody. I'm just kind of thanking, you know, the universe. Just like, thank you.
And you do this at the time you're going through your hardships or your struggle.
I do it when I'm going through my hardships and my struggle. I do it when I'm going through massive windfalls. And believe it or not, it's even harder for me to remember to do it with my massive windfalls, when we're making oodles and oodles and oodles of money, because I get so excited. But I've learned over time, of course, how quickly that can go. And so I kind of dial myself back and try to keep myself centered just with a moment of gratitude. And I that practice of gratitude, I refined even more through a gentleman that I met out in Houston, Dr. John DeMartini.
You refined the process of your gratitude, you're mentioning? Yeah. So what is that process? So tell me, so some of myself and Cody can maybe, and our listeners can learn from.
Well, I guess before it was never really understood why I was giving thanks for things. You know, there was one time where I was in college and I was driving all my friends up to go skiing in Vermont, and my car broke down like 2.5 hours away from the college. And I had to get AAA, and AAA towed me down, and I had to miss the skiing event. And for most people, they would be pissed and have to run back to their dorm room and drink their sorrows away and all the money that you'd have to spend. But I'm sitting in the tow truck with the tow truck driver, and I just kept saying thank you. And I'm going, God, I don't even know why I'm saying thank you. This is just miserable, but thank you. I'm like, thank you, thank you, thank you. And then if it wasn't for that one event, I never would have met my wife. And I met my wife and we're still married today. And I mean, now I understand why that event happened. And through what I learned with DeMartini is that if you look at the yin yang, the place that you want to live is right in the middle. And to get to that middle is gratitude. And so if you get too elated, let's say if you win the lottery, right? You win a $500 million lottery and you're like, "Woo, man, life can't get any better. I'm 500 million bucks. Yes." But then the opposite happens at the same time. You know, now you've got security concerns. Now you got all your friends putting their hands out, expecting a handout. You've got, you know, strangers knocking and calling on your door. You've got to change your phone number. You've got to move. You've got to do all this sort of stuff. And you get this feeling almost like something's weird. You're not used to having $500 million. You know, or on the contrary, right? You might experience something negative, like I shared with you about the tow truck. But something positive is happening. You just don't see it. It's all happening at the exact same time.
Right. Hedonic treadmill. Sorry for interrupting. They had that hedonic treadmill where we get something and then we always want to move. We always want that next thing. And it's very difficult to appreciate what we already have because you just get so used to it. And like you have people who line up for the iPhone and, you know, and then they get that new device and then they're so excited about that. But a lot of the dopamine and a lot of the actual crave for that was the anticipation up to that. It wasn't even owning it. It was just the anticipation leading up to getting that material item. And it's way too easy just when we get something in our lives that it doesn't really bring us happiness. And they've shown studies that show when we go on vacation that we remember those memories. And we don't necessarily remember all the details about that vacation, but if we have a very good happy point, we can remember that good feeling from that vacation. And that reaps a lot more reward over the money spent on that versus any kind of material object. And there's a great TED talk on the idea of gratitude. And they've done research studies to show that when people are depressed, that if you actually have a gratitude journal where just you write down the three things that you're grateful for every single day, that it's been shown to be almost just as effective, if not probably just as effective actually, as an antidepressant in terms of bringing people back up to a sort of a mean of life, a viewing of having a good perspective on life. And it's just so easy to get lost in that, right? Where you achieve that success and it's not good enough and you have to go higher and higher and higher. And there's that perspective of just being content, because happiness isn't something that you get once you get somewhere. It's something that you can choose to have at any moment in time, whether you're rich or you're poor, doesn't matter what shit you're going through. So it's good that you found that perspective of gratitude. And when did you find that perspective? When did you find that being gratitude? Did you learn that from something? Did you read a book? Or did it just like snap in your head one day where you're just like, I need to be grateful in order to be content with myself?
It actually just sort of started happening where I could see myself being thankful and I didn't know why. But then I liked how it felt, mm-hmm. You know, so I just kept that routine going. And, you know, you mentioned something, and I do want to recommend a book to you because it is phenomenal, is The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. Dan Millman, I believe, is the author. I personally have invested over $500,000 in personal and professional development because once you just start realizing how much more life has to offer, it just becomes an addiction. Like, well, what else can I get? And what else can I learn?
What else have you learned besides being more humble and having gratitude?
Well, I think one of the more powerful lessons that I learned was, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I lived the earlier part of my life as a victim, right? I mean, there were situations where, you know, in that real estate development business that I was telling you about, you know, I had at one point some kids running around with BB guns shooting holes in my windows. I had people stealing from my company. I had several death threats. In fact, even caught one gentleman with a shiv in his jacket that admitted to the police that he was there to kill me. I mean, there was, I could go on and on and on with different things. And I got sued by two subcontractors who, because of my age, thought they could take advantage of me. And so I'm sitting there and I know there's, you know, controversy around Tony Robbins, but he actually was the best first step to personal development that I'd ever taken. And so, you know, I met with Tony and Tony said to me, man, do you think you've got big problems or little problems? And I'm like, oh my God, Tony, these are huge, right? And he's like, so let me ask you, who's like one of your professional idols? And I said, Richard Branson. And he goes, okay, so Richard Branson, let me ask you, do you think Richard Branson would look at, you know, two subcontractors suing you and, you know, a couple windows broken and a couple things stolen. Do you think, you know, Richard Branson, what does he own, like 300-400 companies? Do you think that's a big problem or a small problem? And I'm like, to Richard Branson, I guess that would be a small problem. And he's just right. He goes, the thing is small people tend to run away from small from problems all the time. But big people create big problems for themselves. You could measure the size of a person by the size of their problems. So stop being such a, and you know, I don't know who your listeners are, so I won't be swearing, but you know, stop.
That doesn't matter. You can say fuck, shit, whatever you want. That's totally okay.
Yeah, we know Tony too. I mean, not personally, but we've seen him.
Yeah, no, he gives people confidence in themselves. Like, you know, there's some of the stuff that he sells I have issues with, but his main thing that he teaches people is to believe in themselves, because they go through life, have that feeling of helplessness of I'm stupid, I'm incapable, I can't do this, I can't do that. And he tells people, wait, no, you need to change that mindset in order to become the person that you want to be. And he's been that cornerstone behind that change in a lot of people and how they view themselves, because they go to school, they're bullied, and then they believe that they're this person that they, you know, that person, they weren't a jock, they weren't a cheerleader, they weren't somebody that was popular in school. And then they grow up believing that creating that narrative that they just carry from when they were younger, and they don't snap out of it. And that's been, that was me for such a long period of time. I thought it was stupid too. I thought I would never achieve anything. And then once I started to achieve one level of success, it went up to another level and another level. I would read like Forbes and Inc. articles, you know, and that would show me, wait, there are people like Richard Branson who has ADHD, he has dyslexia, and he has seemingly all these things against him, and yet he's able to still be successful. And I would start to look at habits, right? You read that, what's the Charlie, the investor, what's his name?
Munger?
Charlie Munger. And even his other business partner, he would constantly read books. Like he says that he spends most of his time reading books. And so then I would say, okay, if I want to be successful, I should start reading books. And then I started to read books about habits, and I would meditate and I would exercise and I started eating right. And then once I started to form all those pillars, that foundational core of who I am, then that started to allow me to go up that spiral of success, as you might say, in order to become successful. Because, and I'm sorry going on a rant, but you can't, you've never heard of a successful CEO who isn't able to make their bed every day. You know, if you can't make your bed, then there's no way you're going to be that amazing person with that Ferrari and that huge house that you want to be. You have to start small and work your way up via use of self-confidence, via use of gratitude, and so many other things that I can't think of at the moment.
Yeah, I think you got Cody rolling right now on that one. Yeah. Right. But no, absolutely. No, I mean, just to echo a lot of what you were saying before, I think Tony Robbins has had a huge impact on my life as well. And I think what he does do is allow people to put things into perspective. Right. And I mean, he's one person to be able to do so. But I think even just by us having conversation, I think being able to talk to people one on one, we all realize that we all go through our own problems. We all have our own definitions of success as well. I think to measure success against somebody else or with somebody else or their struggles can be very defeating in many ways. But I think in the way to go for improvement is compare yourself to what you were yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. And then what you using yesterday as a metric will help you go towards building the future that you want to be able to create. So it sounds like in many ways, Tony was able to put that into perspective all in all. And then that gave you a way to be grateful and really center yourself altogether.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I learned that, you know, I didn't want to run away from problems, that I actually, what I did want to do is look for ways to create problems, that problems are actually a good thing. I mean, Mother Teresa created this big problem, right? She wanted to end hunger and so forth. And the Dalai Lama has got this big problem. You know, it's not just about money. They create big problems. They want to do big things in their life. You know, and I also understood that it's not about being a victim. And, you know, you put yourself in a position and have to accept both the positives and the negatives. And Tony Robbins actually gave me the example. He said, let me ask you a question. Let's say you jumped in your car and you were driving down the road and you have a green light at this intersection. You drive through the green light and somebody in this green car is wasted out of their mind. They bust through the red light and they smash you and they completely total your car. What happens then? And my initial response was, oh my God, well, of course, you know, I'd sue them and I blah, 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 and yada, yada, yada. And he goes, do you see how emotional you're getting? That's the victim mentality that you're experiencing right now. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? It's not my fault. And he goes, again, victim mentality. Let me ask you, when you get in your car, do you think there's any chance whatsoever that you could drive through an intersection and that some drunk person could hit you? Just do you think there's a chance, even a small probability? And I'm like, yes, there would be. And he goes, right. Own the fact that you accepted the responsibility of getting in your car and accepted the risk that you could get slammed by a drunk person. Own it. And then if it happens, understand, you accepted the risk that it happened. Now deal with it unemotionally. Follow the checkbox. Contact the police, contact the attorneys, let them handle it, but you own it. Don't give your power away to somebody else. Don't give all your power away to the drunk person because that's not going to serve you. If you want to be a powerful person, own where you're at right now. And I'm like, damn, that's pretty good.
Yeah, no, I got inspired right there. That's some deep stuff. I know you're a father of three. And I feel like these are lessons that can be, many people don't even have the opportunity to put life into that perspective at all. And how do you, I guess, nurture that kind of behavior in your children?
I could tell you a couple different stories. The most recent one actually was, so my son, he won his invention convention at school, which then allowed him to go compete in the state convention. And so we're at the state convention and there's three or four judges and he lost. So he didn't win. So right away, everybody who cares for him, they instantly start saying the same thing. Buddy, that's not fair. Yours was the best. It's not fair. It's not fair. It's not fair. You know, my in-laws are telling him it's not fair. You know, my wife and I even started going down that route of, you know, it's not fair and the whole deal. And my parents, you know, they would have said the same thing. And then I stopped and I go, Branson? Yeah, his name is Branson. Can you tell I'm a little obsessed over my goal?
Yeah. What are your other children's name? Is one named Tony as well?
Sage, after Sage Robbins, Tony's wife.
Very nice. Yeah,
Sabrina is the mix between Sage and Branson.
Very cool.
So I said to Branson, I go, hey, you know what, Branson? I know you don't want to hear this, but yeah, it was fair. And he says, Dad, no, it wasn't. And I go, Branson, it was fair. There were three or four judges. Nobody was paid off. It was fair. And he's like, well, what are you telling me, that my invention sucked? And I go, no, I'm not telling you that. I think your invention was great. In fact, I personally thought it should win, but it was fair. And I think that was a really important lesson for him to understand that, you know, I didn't want him to be a victim and be like, it's not fair, it's not fair. I want him to be like, no, look, it was fair. Now, if you want to compete next year, you have to ask yourself, what more do I need to do to win? Similarly, like, how many of you guys, you know, have seen like lemonade stands, kids running lemonade stands?
You know, I'll be honest, I don't think I've ever seen a lemonade stand. I've always kind of joked about this where I was like, what type of business model is this? Who drinks lemonade nowadays? So maybe in New Hampshire, I think I might be missing it out here in Austin, though I feel like in Austin, it'd probably be a little bit more lucrative.
You're probably right.
Right. People need to make barbecue stands out here. That's what will sell. Or Topo Chico. Get up in early. That's the big thing out here in Austin.
There you go.
Right. But anyway, yeah. Sorry, just to cut you off, you were saying, okay, lemonade stands.
Yeah, so I mean, the concept of lemonade stand, kid sells lemonade and so forth, and you know, they get 50 cents, whatever it is. And so, you know, I like this idea of encouraging my kids to be entrepreneurs and so forth. And I'm like, when my son was really young, he was about 4 years old, maybe even younger. I'm like, hey, let's get you a lemonade stand. So the first year I went to the store, got him all the lemonade, got him all set up. He sold his lemonade and made a bundle, and now he loves it. Now next year rolls around, all winter he kept talking about, can't wait to do another lemonade stand. And so I'm getting ready to go to the store, and then I'm like, oh, what lesson am I teaching him? So I said, hey, Branson, come with me for a second. I said, let's sit down. So we sit down on the curb. I go, I need to talk to you. And he says, what's up? And I says, he's five, right? So I said, hey, Branson, so here's how it's going to work. You know, when you were four, you were such a little kid, but now you're bigger now. And so we're going to make a deal here. So I could do what I did last year, and I can go to the store and I can buy all your lemonade and your cups and everything else. And we'll set up the lemonade stand, and we could do that. But because I used my money and I bought all the lemonade and the cups and everything else, it's technically my business. So I'll pay you $2 an hour to run the lemonade stand, and I get to keep all the money. And he says, well, that's not fair. I said, right, you're right. That's not fair. You know, if you wanted to own the business. And he goes, well, then how do I want to own the business? And I go, well, that means you made plenty of money for through Christmas and birthdays and everything else. You got to take your money. You got to go to the store. You got to buy your own lemonade and your own cups and everything else. And then you got to sell it. And then, you know, if you make money, you get to keep all the money. If you lose money, though, you have to understand that, you know, that was the decision that you made. But you can make as much money as you want. Do you want to be a business owner, or do you want to be the employee? And he goes, well, I want to be the business owner. And so we went to the store, and he used all his own money. And the way that he thought was so much different, because now he's looking at the prices of things. He's looking at how much money he has in his wallet. He's asking questions like, Dad, some people might not want lemonade. Some people only want water. Can I buy water? Well, sure. It's $5 for 24. Do you want to do that? Yeah, I want to do that. Okay, no problem. What about fruit, Dad? Should I buy fruit and sell fruit? I don't know. Do you think enough people will buy fruit? Look how much it costs. Oh, probably doesn't make sense. Cool. So we set them all up. Now, I was determined that at worst, he was going to break even, but he wasn't going to lose. So every time he turned around, I ran behind a tree with my cell phone. I'm calling all my friends, get your asses down here and buy some lemonade, right? Because I wanted to make sure that he won. But he had to feel that initial trepidation and the nerves, and he had to start thinking and taking responsibility for the decisions that he was going to make for his lemonade stand, so that, you know, there's a bigger lesson in that than just saying, hey, Dad's going to take care of everything for you.
Hey, wow. It sounds like you're a very proactive parent on that one. That's pretty amazing of you. Maybe when he turns six, we can role play, and I could come in with some VC money and trying to buy his lemonade stand, and then see how he feels afterwards and gauge his emotional response.
That was years ago. So now he's 11 going on 12. So, you know, you're going to have to negotiate a tough bargain with him.
Ooh, okay. So he's probably very witty at this point and can hold his own ground. So yeah, seeing the trajectory that he's already been on.
He's definitely a smart kid. Both my daughters, very, very same thing too. I mean, you can't get anything past those guys.
That's good. It looks like you created a good environment for them to be able to learn, and with enough nurturing, but at the same time, some failure, that they can learn how to accept both of those with humility and gratitude. So it looks like you're doing a lot of the right things too, beyond your business ventures.
I think, you know, you bring up a really good point about failure. So when I lived in Australia, one of the things that was very much looked down upon was failing. If failing means that you are a failure. And I mean, they might not see it quite the same way living down there, being a resident. It was coming from the United States and going to Australia, like it was very apparent. And maybe things have changed now. I mean, I was down there in the 90s, right? But over here, failing, especially in a business venture, is something that, you know what? A lot of entrepreneurs do it. But I think as a kid, you know, we all have an inherent fear of not being smart enough or not being good enough. And there's a certain self-image that you want to uphold. But I think if you start your children young and you actually encourage failure as a good thing, right? I think that you're actually going to help them succeed so much more in life because they won't be afraid to take certain risks than they would be if you only rewarded success. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And on that note, I'm wondering, do you have any books, any content, any podcasts, anything that you've read or consumed that have influenced the way that you perceive being grateful, being humble, viewing failure not as a failure, but as a stepping stone to get to where you want to go?
That's a really good question. And I actually, I don't have any books that I can recommend off the top of my head. So I'm 40 now.
Okay.
And so most of where I've come to today as a result of hiring many, many mentors, number one. And number two, I've been blessed by having quite a bit of struggle. I don't look at the struggle as a bad thing. I mean, if you go to the gym, you have your choice. You could pick up, you know, an empty PVC pipe and do curls. Right? You could do that, no problem. How strong do you think you're going to get? Versus the guy that walks to the gym and tries to put on as much weight as he possibly can. He's shooting for 10 reps, but he only can squeeze out 9. Who do you think's going to get stronger? The guy who puts on all this weight and tries to get 10 reps, but can only squeeze out 9? Or the person that puts weight on the bar and they can get 10 easy peasy? Who's going to get stronger?
Definitely.
I assume the first person. Which person is it?
If it's
easier and you can push it out way too easy, but if the first person is struggling and they're aiming for 10, but they can only do 9, you know, they're maxing it out. So Charles, tell us which one of us is correct.
It's the one who can only get that 9 out, that gives it his all and gets that 9 out. He's the one that's going to get stronger. It's like in jiu-jitsu. I mean, in my introduction, you talked about that I'm a jiu-jitsu fighter, right? And so do you think I'm going to get better by fighting a white belt who I know I can absolutely crush and dominate? Or will I get better by fighting a black belt?
Right. Definitely black belt. But, you know, if you ever need to raise your ego after a potential loss, then you go after the white belt, right? So the failure comes with the win.
They occasionally do.
All right. So I think everybody needs to raise themselves up every once in a while and just let everybody know what their role is during that time period.
Well, you know, but the funny thing is every once in a while, if you fight a black belt enough, every once in a while, you will get lucky. And you will get a submission and you'll feel a hell of a lot better when you submit a black belt than when you submit a white belt, because you should be submitting white belts.
I did martial arts also. And when I got to my black belt, and I feel really bad because, I mean, I was younger, but, you know, my ego would definitely be hurt if I lost to somebody that was a lower rank, being on the flip side of that. But now I'm looking at it from your perspective. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess that there's a learning lesson in both instances, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But wow, Charlie, it's a story of grit, of perseverance, of confidence, going through disability and just perception of how you perceive yourself and how you perceive failure. Charlie, I want to thank you for being on the podcast, and I'll be sure to be in touch.
Awesome. Well, it's been truly my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Hey guys, this is Cody again. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Mind Hack. And if you're interested in getting more Mind Hack worthy stuff straight to your inbox, then you might consider signing up for my weekly newsletter. It often contains links to new episodes, blog posts, and other interesting finds I found on the interweb in the past week. It pretty much focuses around productivity and efficiency. So if that's your thing, then be sure to visit my website at CodyMcLain.com. That's MCLAIN.com to sign up. Also, if there are any interesting websites, companies, books, blog posts, quotes, or anything else that was mentioned in this episode, you can find it all and more by visiting the official website for the Mindhack Show at mindhack.com. And as always, if you have any feedback, good or bad, I want to hear it. Send me a tweet, email, or what have you on either of my websites, as my goal with this show is to give you the maximum value in the shortest amount of time. That's all for now, guys. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you guys again soon.